Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Paul Mendez Flohr, a leading scholar of modern Jewish thought, German Jewish intellectual history, Jewish existentialism, and surely the foremost living scholar of Martin Buber. Mendez Flohr teaches at University of Chicago's Divinity School and is professor emeritus at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's currently writing a new biography of Buber for Yale University Press. Paul, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Paul, let's start with how you came to study Buber and why you find Buber's work so compelling that you've continued to focus on it for going on half a century. You talk a little bit about the origins of your work on Buber in the preface to your first book on Buber, From Mysticism to Dialogue, and how you discovered him in a seminar at Brooklyn College. But I'm interested as well in hearing you talk about the development of your study of Buber under the tutelage of Nachum Glatzer at Brandeis, since he was one of the great scholars of Jewish thought in his generation. So how did you come to study Buber? Why did Buber's work speak to you? What was it like studying Buber with Glatzer, and how did he influence you as a scholar?
The origins of my interest in Buber goes back to when I lived in the kibbutz at the age of 18. And it was considered de rigueur, one of the essential works of the kibbutz experience. Of course, I didn't understand a word. I had no ambitions about expatiating on Buber at that time. As I was drawn to Buber more in an academic fashion, of course, my voice became more hesitant and more uncertain. But that's the nature of an academic experience. At least initially, you're humbled. I had the opportunity to study Buber in a more rigorous fashion under the tutelage, as you noted, of Nachum Glatzer, a German-educated scholar who came to the United States, well, actually in the wake of Hitler, but after having lived a spell in Israel, or the land of Palestine, if you wish, came to study this teaching in the United States and was one of the founding figures of Brandeis University, where I did my graduate work. It was not only Glatzer who was a trioker of German-educated scholars who established the program of Jewish studies at Brandeis University, but Glatzer was the main figure. And I was blessed, if you wish, by the fact that he took an interest in me and my work and introduced me not only to the writings of Buber, but the whole aura of German Jewish thought, the earnestness, the even urgency of Jewish modern Jewish thought as it took shape in Germany. And he was a very patient and supportive teacher. And my doctorate, which I wanted to thank my mentors, not only Glatzer, but the others, I found a citation from George Eliot. And she said that George, she was obviously at a time when women weren't allowed to present themselves as women, so she did kind of a fictitious name of a male, but it was a woman. In any event, George Eliot once said that those who trust us educate us. And I had that experience with Glatzer and others at Brandeis. They somehow trusted me, trusted my intellect, trusted my, I guess, my spiritual journey, and I was thus educated. And that is, in fact, the very core of Buber's legacy, trust, how to nurture trust and to sustain trust.
Trust being obviously the basis of relationship. And we'll come to discussing how that notion works in Buber in more detail. But before we get started on discussing Buber, let's put him into a broader framework that obviously you were introduced to as a graduate student and that you've become one of the leading scholars of, the German Jewish intellectual experience more broadly. Your book, German Jews, gives a sweeping overview of the cultural history of German intellectuals from the origins of this community in the figure and the circle around Moses Mendelssohn in the 18th century through Buber's generation, which affected a renaissance in German Jewish intellectual life in the early 20th century. In that book, you navigate between two approaches that you clearly think misrepresent the German Jewish experience. First, that the cultural integration of Jews in Germany was doomed, and that the German-Jewish symbiosis was naive, and that ultimately this was proven to be the case with Nazism. And second, that it was singularly Jews. And here one can think of all, you know, a whole series of great names, Marx, Freud, Schopenhauer, Kafka, that it was singularly Jews who were the prophets of modernity, which neglects the influence of German culture on Jews. So, at a clip, can you give us a sense of the dilemmas of modern Jewish intellectual life by explaining why the subtitle of the book is A Dual Identity and why the first chapter is called The Bifurcated Soul of the German Jew?
Of course, in some sense, the German Jewry is a paradigm of Jewish modernity in general. The very nature of modernity is that we are all somehow syncretistic, or to use a more common term, where a salad made up of various ingredients, we're no longer singularly Jewish or singularly German or Japanese. There's a sort of, if you wish, a cosmopolitan impulse to modernity. I recently wrote a piece on the nature of a library and traced this development from a classical Jewish library, which had only, or at least primarily, religious texts, to the secular library. I have in my home, Jerusalem, it's my primary home still, perhaps 15,000 volumes. Don't ask my wife. She'd be very distraught to remind her of it. They collect dust as well as interest. But I have, of course, in my library, books of the Jewish tradition, but I also have books, many, many books of German, Japanese, art history, etc. It's the nature of our intellectual life as well as our cultural life that we are syncretistic, that we combine various elements, that we're open to all human experiences. Indeed, that's one of the founding principles of the Enlightenment. And I say Enlightenment because European Jewry encountered modernity through the Enlightenment, is that we are primarily members of a human family. And I study Japanese or Chinese culture not because I'm a voyeur, I'm just curious, but I understand it to be part of my own spiritual legacy. Spiritually, I am a composite of all of human experiences. For shorthand, I refer to it as a bifurcated soul, that we are both still passionately Jewish, perhaps, engaged by a Jewish intellectual and cultural and spiritual legacy, but also compelled by other experiences. So German Jews emphasized that they were German Jews, often neglecting the fact that historians of this experience neglect the fact that they were still Jewish in terms of their commitment. Of course, there are examples of those who negated their Judaism in order to be part of a German culture, to be accepted. And as the underlying concern was the fact that the struggle for emancipation was a very protracted one. Jews were granted certain rights, then rescinded by other moments. And that obviously informed the way Jews sought to acquire respectability, acceptance, through asserting that we are part of the German cultural experience. But for the most part, German Jews did not relinquish or abandon their Jewish concerns and developed in this sort of dialogue between general culture, particularly sponsored by German culture, and their Judaism, a unique synthesis, which gave birth to much of what we call modern Judaism, Reform Judaism, conservative Judaism, and even Orthodoxy as an expression of the German Jewish experience.
As well, of course, to many of the great products of cultural modernity, just witnessed by the names that I mentioned. But I do want to return to this issue of the library, because I'm specifically wondering whether those German Jewish intellectuals had in their library Jewish texts. So when you talk about the fact that they did not relinquish, they never assimilated, they might have culturally integrated, but they didn't assimilate. Did they continue to read great Jewish texts to engage in Jewish culture in a serious and thoughtful and reflective way?
Well, one of the casualties of this attempt to embrace general culture, particularly German culture, was a loss of knowledge of Hebrew, at least a knowledge that allowed one to continue to read the core texts of the Jewish canon, if you wish, in the original language, Hebrew and Aramaic. So it was a process of translation. Also, there's a shift in the way we understand knowledge. Rather than turning to primary sources, the historians get into the game and create historical studies. So we have lots of histories of the Jews, history of Jewish literature, etc. And that expression of Jewish knowledge, for the most part, dominated the libraries, so to speak, or the intellectual landscape of German Jewry. A knowledge of the primary texts was lost until, as you mentioned, the so-called Jewish Renaissance in the early 20th century.
And we'll return to that in just a minute. Paul, let's now turn to Buber. He was born into a strongly Jewish tradition. Those books were certainly on the shelves in his home. He was born in Vienna in 1878 to an Orthodox Jewish family, the son of a renowned scholar of rabbinic literature. Tell us a little about his upbringing and some of the early shaping experiences that defined his life.
I hope you won't be offended if I correct you. He was the grandson of a great scholar, Shlomo or Solomon Buber. For many years, Buber suffered because he was always known in Jewish circles as the grandson of Solomon or Shlomo or Shloimi in the Yiddish inflection thereof. His grandfather was one of the great patrons of Jewish scholarship and a scholar of his own right of Midrash. Until this very day, many of the edited editions, the critically edited editions of Midrash, are the work of Shlomo Buber.
And when we talk about Midrash, we're talking about the stories, the
homiletic literature of Judaism. expounding upon the Torah and the Jewish teachings in a more imaginative fashion, if you wish. But it's in a massive literature, and Shlomo Buber did a great service by retrieving many of the lost texts. Remember, until the age of printing, all this was in Jewish learning was as Christian and Islamic learning were in manuscripts. So he retrieved the manuscripts and then provided us with printed versions of those manuscripts. And since the manuscripts were handwritten, they're often variations of who the scribe was. So that's what we mean by a critically edited edition. But Buber was raised by his grandparents. His parents divorced when he was 3. And then he was sent to live with his grandparents, who lived in an area called Galicia, which is part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, but was more of a traditional, in terms of Jewish life, a more of a traditional concentration or a concentration of traditional Jewish life. At home, Buber spoke Yiddish. Went to school in Polish. Of course, at home, he had lessons in Hebrew. He knew Hebrew very well. Grandfather certainly made efforts that he would be an educated Jew, educated in terms of Jewish materials, Jewish texts. And he also had a general education. He went to a Polish gymnasium, a high school, but learned German as well. In fact, Buber's first publications were in Polish and not in German. At the age of 18, he went to study in the university in Vienna, where he slowly shifted to German as his primary educated language or academic language. And he had roots in the tradition. So he's not a typically assimilated Jew, as often somehow we think of him that way. But he grew up with the tradition. There's a wonderful anecdote that during the Nazi period, where Buber serves more or less as the shepherd of German Jewry that was incrementally isolated, re-ghettoized, if you wish, there were times where the community wanted to pray, and no one had a prayer book, but Buber knew the prayer book by heart, which only is an indication of the type of education he had in his youth. And of course, what is crucial for the Buber that we know, so to speak, has a public image, is in his youth, his grandfather introduced him to Hasidism. There was a large Hasidic community. In fact, his grandmother came from a Hasidic family. And eventually Buber would introduce so-called assimilated Jews or acculturated Jews and the general public at large to the mystical, spiritual life of the Hasidim.
So let's turn to that aspect of Buber's work, Paul, because he came of age with the Second Industrial Revolution and in a world that was rapidly changing. His early work focused on mysticism, and it was developed in a context that was shared by a large group of Central European intellectuals whose zeitgeist was, as you write, quote, a romantic discontent with modernity. So what were Buber's reservations about modernity, and why did he seek myth and mysticism as a solution? And maybe to make this concrete, you can talk a little bit more about how Buber came to interpret the Jewish Hasidic mystical tradition as a solution to some of the problems of modernity.
Modernity was associated, or the crisis, or what they call the discontent with modernity, was associated with the rise of urban civilization. Europe in the 19th century was characterized by rapid urbanization, with all the dislocations attendant thereof, namely what we call the urban proletariat, immigrants who came from the countryside and or of different cultures, different cultures and countries, suddenly sought employment in the rapid industrialization, which was focused in the urban centers. So there was a great deal of poverty. Advent of a culture many people didn't really quite fully feel at home with, advertisement, rapid transportation. Today we're very comfortable with it, but initially it was disruptive and uncertain exactly what was being attained by this experience called urbanization, or under the larger rubric, modernity. Within that, there was a sense that the very basis of modern culture had to be re-examined, if I may use such a term, epistemological. If you regard that as a dirty word, you may erase it, but nonetheless. In other words, our understanding of how we achieve knowledge, what is knowledge, as opposed to misguided opinion. So the epistemological basis of modern culture was re-examined. And within that re-evaluation, exploration, mysticism was rediscovered. And young Martin Buber played a major role in excavating mystical and mythic traditions that were lost in this process of modernization and therefore their retrieval. The first books Buber wrote were not necessarily Jewish. He published an enormous amount of books on Finnish myth, on Chinese myth, on German myth and mysticism. And he gained great renown as a student of mysticism and myth in general. And at one point he decided, well, we may as well bring his own Jewish tradition into the repertoire. And he published two books of Jewish Hasidic myths on legends. I should mention what Hasidism, for the audience that may be not familiar with it, the plural in Hebrew is Hasidim or Hasidism. It's a 18th century movement of popular mysticism that took root in the Ukraine and Poland, and which Buber experienced, as I noted, in his youth. Popular in the sense that every Jew, the simplest of Jews, can have access to the experience of the divine, and not necessarily through learning, but through storytelling, through dance, through music. So the comprehensive sense of the mystical that Buber brought to expression in his first two volumes of Hasidic piety and mysticism.
So a lot of what Buber was reacting against was a modern world in which people felt atomized and disconnected from one another, and reacting against the individualism of modern life, the fact that communities themselves were breaking down, where each person had a place and knew their place. Mm-hmm. And mysticism for him was a pathway to some broader sense of unity that had been lost in the modern experience. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Paul Mendez-Flohr, a leading scholar of modern Jewish thought, who visited Memphis in January to give the Modern Prophets lectures. Paul, Buber was also an early Zionist, and with the rise of the Nazis, which you alluded to, he ended up emigrating to what was then Mandate Palestine in 1938, where he lived for the remainder of his life. But his Zionism was animated less by the politics of state building, or as a response to anti-Semitism, than by a desire for the renewal of Judaism. And he remained throughout his life very much a dissident and prophetic voice when it came to the relation between Jews and Arabs. You edited his writings on this topic and published it with the telling title, A Land of Two Peoples. Tell us a little about Buber's Zionism and his viewpoint on Jewish-Arab coexistence or binationalism.
Zionism, like Judaism in general, is a coat of many colors. At its founding, there were two main impulses. The movement was founded in the late 19th century, and one impulse was to respond to anti-Semitism. And another impulse was to somehow adjust Judaism to modernity, to overcome many of what was perceived then to be the problems of modernity, particularly as they affected Jews. So there was a nice way of expressing that in German, which was the lingua franca of Jews in the 19th and early 20th century. Those who emphasized anti-Semitism and sought a political response to anti-Semitism through establishing a sovereign Jewish state referred to the Judennot, the distress of the Jewish people, as engendered by anti-Semitism. Another impulse, known as cultural Zionism, spoke of the Not des Judentums, the distress of Judaism within the context of modernity. Buber was associated with the latter, concerned for the renewal of Judaism within terms of the modern experience. Some of his colleagues were concerned simply of reformulating Judaism as a secular culture through resuscitation of Hebrew as a vernacular, everyday language, or a language of imagination. For Buber, the renewal of Judaism as a culture also had to have its roots in the spiritual and religious heritage of Judaism. And that's often forgotten when we discuss Buber in terms of these categories. He was a cultural Zionist, but perhaps better put, a spiritual Zionist. And when he came to live in the land of Israel, but even before that, he was deeply concerned about the conflict with the indigenous Arab population. And he saw that conflict as ultimately a test of Judaism and its spiritual resources. So thus he coined the notion that the Arab question, as it was understood within terms of Zionist politics, is ultimately a Jewish question, akin to what was known as the Jewish question in Europe. The difficulty, the hesitation of Europe to integrate the Jews as full citizens was ultimately a test of the resources, the spiritual and intellectual resources of Christianity. And unfortunately, at a time, it seemed to fail. He didn't want the Jews to fail. The Arab question is ultimately a Jewish question. It's a test of the spiritual and intellectual, moral, ethical resources of Judaism. And that's the way he understood it. Not purely as a political problem. You can solve it politically, perhaps, by having alliances with great powers and subduing the Arabs, but that would be a Pyrrhic victory. Certainly, it would be a defeat of the spiritual and moral challenge faced by the need to share the land of Israel. And thus, Buber spoke of a land of two peoples. Two peoples dwell in this land, and they have to learn to live with one another in justice and dignity for the sake of each, and certainly for the sake of, from Buber's point of view, of Judaism.
Paul, Buber is today most famous as the author of I and Thou, written in 1923, which would have an enormous influence not only on the key Jewish philosophers of the 20th century like Franz Rosenzweig and Immanuel Levinas, but exert a massive influence as well on Christian theologians. The opening lines of I and Thou read as follows. The attitude of man is twofold in accordance with the two basic words he can speak. The basic words are not single words, but word pairs. One basic word is the word pair I-thou. The other basic word is the word pair I-it. Can you unpack what Buber means by I-it as opposed to I-thou relations and explain what Buber was on about in this book and why it had such an influence on modern religious thought for both Jews and Christians?
Yeah. I should just mention that the only Jew Buber mentions in I and Thou is Jesus, and he mentions it quite extensively in Buddhist figures. It is meant as a universal principle and not specifically a Jewish one. Later on, he would indicate that Judaism, as he understood it, gives witness to this principle, embodies this principle, but it's a universal principle that is meant to speak to ultimately the experience of every human being. Towards the end of his life, Buber was once challenged by a radio interview to give a thumbnail sketch of his thinking. And he said, well, all I have done through my writing is to bring the reader, person I'm in discussion with, to a window, open the window and point out what we should all see, and that is the centrality of relationships. There are two forms of relationships, broadly speaking. One is where you relate to the other person as an independent subject, just as yourself, with a soul, if you wish, with an ego, with wounds of one's experience, but also, of course, the moments of joy that all constitute our who we are. And that Buber referred to in German, I-du being the German word for an intimate, trusting relationship, as opposed to an I-it relationship. It referring to objects. We often, because of this, I'm holding now a bottle of water or a pen. These are objects. What is problematic is when we treat one another as objects. And we can do that in many, many subtle ways, casting them according to stereotypes. You don't see me, but I'm virtually bald, bespeckled, and I'm now 70 years old, so you can say, well, there's a bald, bespeckled old man or senior citizen, if you want to be kind. But that would still be referring to me as an it, as opposed to a thou, as it's translated in English, or the simple word of trust in German, du. That's the distinction Buber had in mind. And we often forget that other human beings, even if they're distant from us culturally, racially, ethnically, religiously, are not simply objects that we categorize as Jew, black, or whatever, old or young, beautiful or less, but they're independent realities that we should relate to.
Paul, Buber would also have a close working relationship with Franz Rosenzweig, the other titan of Jewish existentialism. Together, they'd work on a new translation of the Bible into German, and Buber would lecture at the Jüdische Lehrhaus, the adult education center that Rosenzweig created to innovate and revitalize Jewish learning. What made Buber and Rosenzweig existentialists, and how did their religious existentialism reinvigorate Jewish philosophy?
So we begin with Jewish existence. Rosenzweig, who was a bit younger than Buber, came from an assimilated background and indifferent to his Judaism, and a certain stage in his life discovered his Judaism, but discovered it in terms of his own individual reality. And so his reappropriation of Jewish knowledge and Jewish devotional forms, he became more or less what we call a practicing Jew. Prayed three times a day, observed dietary laws, etc. That reappropriation began with his own individual experience, his own situation in life, the questions that arose from that personal reality, in that sense, existential. Also, the Judaism speaks not only to our intellect, but to our being, to our existence, the meaning of our lives. Lives as individuals and lives as members of a community, lives of a larger family we call humanity. In that sense, they are existentialists. I mean, of course, there are philosophical nuance we need not go into now. But
Buber and Rosenzweig were central figures in the renaissance of Jewish intellectual life in the Weimar period that you alluded to earlier, the era following World War I and before the rise of the Nazis. What made this a time of rebirth in German Jewish life that would ultimately be cut down in its heyday by the Nazis?
Yes. Well, precisely as we indicated, the existential moment. It was an existential moment not only for Jews, but for all of Europeans in the wake of the First World War, where cultured nations, nations that were led by the ethic and vision of the Enlightenment, of democratic, liberal, and tolerant society, a culture that placed greater emphasis on education would lead us to paradise, at least lead us to
ever-increasing progress and development.
Endless progress. And sometimes even referred to human perfection. And suddenly that collapsed in the wake of the First World War, where for 4 years of protracted, brutal conflict that no one really understood how it began, why it was fighting, why it was taking place, other than under the slogans of nationalism, led to a deep, deep crisis in European civilization, what we now call existential crisis. That means all issues regarding the meaning of life came to the fore. And within that context, Jews also suffered. Likewise, one must remember that the First World War also triggered pogroms. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed in the wake of the First World War pogroms, particularly in Eastern Europe. But not only, anti-Semitism emerged as a ferocious force in the wake of the First World War. So there was the existential crisis was also had a particular Jewish dimension. And led by Rosenzweig and Buber and others was that Judaism can be existentially relevant, can address these questions, these most urgent questions of our existence. And it's just not the slogans of Judaism, but the whole literary tradition, spiritual tradition of Judaism. And for some, like Rosenzweig, was even the practice, the nature of Jewish prayer and Jewish ritual, the Jewish religious calendar, likewise can help us address these questions. And it led to, a rebirth, a renaissance that was brutally cut down in the Nazi period.
Paul Mendes-Flohr, thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint. You've introduced us to Buber in particular and through him to a number of other figures who offer us prophetic insight. I mean, it seems that the kinds of issues that they raised weren't only issues for the post-World War I period, but indeed are issues that are ongoing in the dawn of the 21st century.
Thank you.
Paul Mendes-Flohr's Modern Prophets lectures were part of the Communities in Conversation series at Rhodes College. Always free and open to the public, Communities in Conversation will continue in the fall of 2012, highlighting academics and intellectuals whose viewpoints can help transform the public discussion of important issues we face locally and globally. For more information, visit facebook.com/communities.in.conversation. And to hear this episode of Counterpoint, or to listen to past conversations, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the Counterpoint link located underneath the news menu item. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.